Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, friends. This is Paula Thompson, and you're on Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. It's a beautiful morning here in Colorado. It's supposed to get colder, but right now I'm going to take the nice weather every moment I can get it. Yesterday was fabulous. It was in the 60s, and today it's going to be in the upper 50s. I'm sorry for you guys on the East Coast if you're getting dumped on. We are in really great weather here, and my dear friend is on the phone, Gerdine Odell. She's our guest today. She's in sunny New Mexico, and we have another friend, Ron, on the phone with us today, and he's in sunny Florida. I assume those two places are sunny. They normally are. Kristen's not with us yet, but I imagine she'll be calling in here pretty soon. We've asked Gerdine on the show today because she's written several books. She's a very good writer. I highly recommend her work. She is an active participator on many Urantia lists and discussion boards. She's always articulate and sensitive to other people's points of view and well-spoken about her own point of view. Very, very interesting person. Gerdine, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Paula. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, I'm so glad to have you. And Ron? Ron, you're on the phone with us still, right?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, great. If you have to put it on mute, Ron's at work listening, so and he's familiar with Gerdine's work, so he may want to give us a comment or two. So if you want to come back on, if you want to put it on mute or not, Ron, that's fine. Just speak up anytime you like. Gerdine, I was told recently that your book, you wrote a book that compares the seven chakras to the seven adjutant mind spirits, which is a teaching from the Urantia book.
Yes.
And I have always felt like that is just a natural match. And I like to take those patterns that are existing in our world and in our world religious cultures and explore them from the teachings of the Urantia book because it just makes so much sense to me. So what got you on that, you know, that notion? I heard your book, by the way, I heard your book got a nomination for an award or an award in New Mexico.
It did. It was nominated for the 2010 New Mexico Book Awards, which was quite an honor. I did not win the first prize, but I was nominated, and that was grand. I got a kick out of, you know, they critique the books, and then they send you the results of the critique. And one comment by one of the critiquers was that basically that it had been written before. And I thought, well, this is a good reason not to pay any attention to critics, because obviously this person has no idea what they're talking about. It has never been written before, because it's only an idea that's been thought of by maybe half a dozen people. And how many of those people are writers? It's because of the esoteric nature of chakras and adjutant mind spirits, and then to put them together, it's really, probably in 10 or 15 years it will be a common concept, but today it's still kind of off the wall. There is a woman on Facebook I've been talking with, a Urantia book reader, who has done some serious study about this, and we've had some really great talks on the net about, wait a minute, can't reach here. What's her name? I haven't met her, but Esther Wood. Anybody know Esther Wood? She's great. She's got an article in Spiritual Retreat Network publication. Anyway, she and I have had some great talks about the adjutants and chakras and how they compare. And they are. They're a natural fit, hand in glove. You have to give it a little creative license. The chakras are lined up and presented linearly, beginning with the lower chakra and working your way up. The adjutant mind spirits are not particularly linear, but they, even the revelators in the Urantia book, say that we are linear thinkers. We they put things in order so that we can understand them, and so I took the liberty of putting the adjutants in order, and the order of the chakras, so as to introduce the chakras to people who already are familiar with chakras. So that critic who said it's been done already, she's right. There have been tons of books out about the chakras, and I am flagrantly piggybacking on the concept. But as one of my selling points is that the Eastern and Western spirituality are coming into at-one-ment here. The merging of Eastern philosophy and, I call Urantia book, Western philosophy, perhaps because it has Christian overtones as compared to Hindu or Buddhist. But it was an attempt to marry the two cultures, as it were. And then I mentioned also that the you remember Machaventa Melchizedek was teacher of Salem, and his Sethite priests wandered around and took his teachings into different places, and it's been proposed that the teachings of Melchizedek about the chakras went into India and became seeds that were planted as the chakra system. So there's a historic connection.
I find that the Hindu teachings have a lot of interesting concepts that are very similar to your Urantia book concepts. And I just want to recap for people who may not be familiar with the seven adjutants. They are called by names which are the equivalents of the following designations: intuition, understanding, courage, counsel, courage, knowledge, counsel, worship, and wisdom. So the first is the spirit of intuition, quick perception. The second is the spirit of understanding, the impulse of coordination. The third is the spirit of courage, the fidelity endowment in personal beings. The fourth is the spirit of knowledge, the curiosity mother of adventure and discovery. The fifth is the spirit of counsel, the social urge. The sixth is the spirit of worship, the religious impulse. And the seventh is the spirit of wisdom, which is the inherent tendency of all moral creatures towards orderly and progressive evolutionary attainment. So there are the seven, and if you look at the chakras, the first one is red, the root. The second one is the spirit of understanding or biology, which is orange. That's the second chakra up. The first one is the base chakra. The second one is right where the reproductive organs would be. The third one is the spirit of courage, which is right in your solar plexus. That's the yellow chakra. The fourth one is the spirit of knowledge. That's your heart chakra. That's the green chakra. The fifth one is the spirit of counsel. Very interesting. That's the blue chakra, the voice chakra. The sixth one is the spirit of worship. Of course, that's the indigo chakra. That's the third eye. And the seventh one is the spirit of wisdom, which is the violet chakra. That's the seventh one, the crown. So I just wanted to give that little background there, and you can see how even just describing that and the different chakras and the colors, how they match up with those seven spirits of the seven adjutants. And I also wanted to mention to you, Gurdeen, that Nigel Nunn years ago did a paper on, and Nigel Nunn is a scientist that lives in Australia.
I'm familiar with his name.
Yeah. He did a paper called The Mind of Adjusted Humans, based on teachings from the Urantia book. And he made that correlation, too. He showed the seven adjutants coming in essentially at seven centers, which, of course, as we know, those seven centers are the chakras.
Yeah.
And it's very, very interesting to me how they line up and how they mesh and compare. And I just wanted to add one more thing, I want to get your insights and you know, where your journey led you as you read this book, or as you wrote it, I'm sorry. I have found that there's a pattern there in the Urantia book as well, with seven epochs of evolution. And the Urantia book says that every world evolves pretty much the same way. Every inhabited world and all of creation is similar in that there are seven major epochs of evolution, and each one of these epochs is characterized by what the Urantia book calls an epical revelation. And the first revelation is the planetary prince, and that corresponds to the first chakra, which is the root. And the planetary prince brings the root of all basic civilization, the root of language, the root of mathematics and science, the root of philosophy and religion. The second evolutionary epoch is the biologic epoch, and that's the second revelation, which is the revelation on all planets, I think, of Adam and Eve. All planets have these first two are exactly the same. They have the planetary prince. He's the first one. The second one is the Adam and Eve. They bring biology to the planet. They upstep the entire planet with their biology. That's the second chakra, the orange chakra, the chakra of biology. It's very interesting. On our world, the third chakra is the golden chakra, the solar plexus. On our world, the light of light and of truth had almost gone extinct. And a Melchizedek son made an emergency mission on our planet, to restore the light of truth. So the golden white light of truth is the third revelation on this planet in the third chakra. The fourth revelation on this planet was our bestowal sun, a paradise sun, and all worlds get a bestowal sun, a paradise sun. We were very lucky we got the creator of this universe. We got Jesus of Nazareth, the master Michael of Nebadon as well, the creator sun. The fourth chakra is the heart, the green chakra, and if ever there was a revelation of love, of the Father's love, it was Jesus. And so I find it very apropos that he was the fourth revelation, the heart revelation, the revelation of love, the green revelation. Interestingly, the fifth revelation is the blue revelation, and that, of course, is the revelation of counsel, the throat. The blue chakra is the throat chakra. Now comes the big blue book that we tell each other about in the age of communication. And I just really feel that's an interesting pattern right there. That's, you know, here is this book that we get to tell each other about in the age of communication. And boy, are we talking about it. I mean, your Rancho Book readers love to talk about this book. And we're talking online and we're talking, you know, we just talk a lot about this book. And it's a privilege and an honor to tell the world, even though the world sometimes does not want to know about it. Man, we just feel so compelled to tell each other about it. And that's the blue chakra, the throat chakra. And if that pattern follows, then the sixth revelation will open our third eye. And I believe it will be the indigo revelation. And, of course, the seventh revelation will be the violet revelation, which, you know, hopefully is the age of light and life. And the Marantia temple comes down upon the world like a crown, the crown chakra. So that's just my little theory of the pattern of those, you know, and we know that seven is a master number and a primary.
And is that your concept, or was that Nigel's about comparing them?
That comparing them to the epical revelations is my concept. Nigel did what you are doing, and he kind of shows how they plug in to the human being in the seven centers, how the seven adjectives.
I love your theory, and I'd like to maybe eventually do an extension of that, but I haven't really studied it sufficiently, and pull in the seven psychic circles, because I feel that we experience these adjutants through our chakras seven times in the development of our full-on, full-fledged spiritual standing. By the time we've gone through them seven times, we ought to be talking to our indwelling adjuster and reflecting God pretty clearly. I think Chris Alverson has some ideas on this, too, that he's been setting forth. I can't speak to them intelligently because I haven't heard them, but
Musa
I heard
and Daye
that he's also had. Huh?
Musa and Daye from Senegal in Africa is a professor, a university professor, and quite a guru in his own right. I mean, he's mastered the Urantia teachings, and he teaches them to others. And one of his specialties is the seven adjutants and how they come through and their particular functions. So, and by the way, I need to mention that my dear friend and co-host, Crystalline, has joined us. Hello, Crystalline.
Hi, Crystalline.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm having some phone problems this morning, so I don't
know
how
clear. Well,
I'm glad
you made it. So,
how clear is it?
It sounds pretty good. Yeah, to me. And, yeah.
Well, it's been very crackly and very hazy for me, so I hope that it doesn't cause any interference. But good morning. Good morning, Gerdine.
Good morning. I'm a little scratchy. Maybe I'm the one that's a little scratchy this morning.
This is Ron, and it all sounds fine to me, so go on.
Ron from Florida is on the phone with us as well, Crystalline. So,
hello.
Know.
Hi, Crystalline. How are you?
I'm doing really well, thanks.
Good. Carry on.
So, Gurdina, go ahead and maybe expound a little bit on your book. The book is called, go ahead and tell us the title.
It's called Spirits of Promise.
Seven Spirits of Promise. You want
to? I'll chat a bit about it. Yeah, sure. This is what writers write for, so that they can discuss their philosophies that they've set to print. This book came about, it's material that I transmitted in, I guess it was 2002, and I found it very interesting material. And so at a conference in Boise, I put on a workshop, and it was well received, and then later on it was transmitted again to the group that I was with here in New Mexico, and it aroused some curiosity, but not much. So I didn't feel that there was really a fire under it, or that it was material that we couldn't live without. And yet, it's like any creation. It's like your kids, you know. Once they've come into existence, they don't just stay nicely in the corner. They make a noise, and they want to be seen and heard, and you have to feed them and take them places and dress them up. And so eventually, it sat there as transmitted material for quite some time. And then this New Mexico Book Awards came up, and I needed some stimulation to keep going. I'm old and unwell, so don't let that alarm anybody, but sometimes I get down in the dumps and feel I need something to live for, something to get excited about. So I put this book together fairly quickly in order to enter it into the book awards in a timely fashion. And so the book came about almost unexpectedly. I got a little hint every now and then that it might have value, but it was one of those ideas that just wouldn't go away. And so now it has been copyrighted and put into the Library of Congress, so it's on record. Spirits of Promise have made their literary debut. I've given not just the talk in Bogus Basin, which was to a group of Urantia people. I also, in 2007, gave a talk presentation on the concept in a New Age bookstore here in New Mexico. And nobody left. Nobody walked out on it. And they seemed to be interested enough. They were gracious. They listened. So I get the feeling that this is one of those concepts that's it's alluring, and it has fascination, but it's, what do you do with it? Is it just another recovery tool? Is it another self-help kind of thing? I don't think that they've made the connection that we can study our adjutants, become familiar with them, recognize them operating in us, understand how we work, understand then how other people work, how they react and function and respond to life, so as to understand each other as a living organism, and not just as a living organism, but as a conscious, sensitive, intelligent human being, compassionate, because we have those last two adjutants in there that add the spiritual dimension to us, so that we are not just the human animal, which is in itself a tremendously wonderful and noble estate. That's one of the most fascinating things about this study, was finding all the ways that we compare to the animal kingdom, how we are so good at getting our needs met and surviving and have our, the second chakra stuff, the spirit of understanding. We understand who can overpower us and who can get things done for us. We understand the pecking order. We understand who the power players are and what our strengths are. Just as animals do. You know, puppies will roll over and let the big dog have an upper hand. And these are things that humans do also, at least healthy ones do. And, of course, it's all to find ways to maximize the human condition, how we can be the best we can be, understand us, understand ourselves, so we can do something about it. But I'm in recovery. I'm a woman in recovery, as we say, and this kind of stuff is fascinating. If you're going to have to do a daily inventory, you need to have something to do it about. If you're going to get into self-revealing of your nature, you have to be able to look at it with rigorous honesty. And there are days when I have to say, well, I behaved a bit like a cat there. I was really catty, and there was no excuse for it. This kind of thing. So it to me is a pertinent tool to help me understand myself better. When I understand myself better, I can understand others better. I'm more easy to forgive because I've done the same thing, oh blah, oh blah. Anyway, any opportunity to talk about the Urantia book, recovery, higher power, spiritual energy, that's something I'm going to take an interest in. And so this book has kept me amused now off and on for nearly 10 years. So it was not that difficult to put out, however, and it's frankly a very elemental book. It's basically three parts after the introduction. And the first part is the talk I gave to the Urantia group at Bogus Basin. The second part are the transmissions that introduced the theory. And part three is the conference I gave at the Corrales bookstore in 2007. So it's not like I put a huge amount of gray matter into it. I don't know if it was a subconscious uprising, a superconscious impression, or how it was manifested. But I've enjoyed it. It hasn't been hard. It's not been difficult at all. So,
I just wanted to ask. You said it wasn't difficult at all, but whereas, you know, one of your other books, your Zoid Mission.
The Zoid Mission.
You said it took more than 20 years for you to write it.
It did. It took 20 years. That was hard.
Published. So that sounds like it wasn't too easy.
No, it wasn't easy at all. It was very difficult, very challenging. And that's the one I'm most proud of, too, of the three books I put out. That's my book. And, that one took 20 years. But it was, if I can talk about that one for a minute.
Oh, I'd love it if you would. I'm fascinated with that book.
My first husband and I, we were both very, very early Urantia book readers. And this goes back to 1968 when I met him. And during our courtship, he courted me by appealing to my ambition to be a writer. And so he cultivated the relationship through writing and challenged me and said, we'll both write a book. Well, first we wrote a screenplay together, which was really quite fun. But the next challenge then was that we would each write a book. We would challenge each other and stimulate each other. And so we both sat back and thought about what shall we write about and compared notes. And after we were into it, barely, but into it, he withdrew and said, I'm not going to follow through with this. I'm busy. I'm doing something else, or I've lost interest, or I'm working and can't, whatever. I can't remember what it was, but he backed out, which infuriated me. But it left me with, oh, and he said, here, you take my script, my concept, and see if you can use it. If you can use my concept and work it into your concept, you're welcome to it. And they were diametrically opposed. They were so removed from each other. I didn't see any way that I would ever be able to marry the two ideas. And yet I did ponder them, and eventually they did merge. And that was a huge undertaking. See if I can remember what they were. That was a long time ago. My concept was, what if the world today were run by Jesus and his 12 apostles? How would he run the world today? And Alan, his name was Alan Smith, Alan's idea was, I forget, but it's in there. And I think it had more to do with, never mind, I can't remember. Anyway, it was huge. Huge challenge for me to marry the two, and so I did, and that took a while. But the things that took time was research. I did a lot of research on this. For example, prisons. I had been arrested as a hippie, which was a very unpleasant experience. I'm no more criminal than the man in the moon. But the system, as it is just ridiculously, pathetically brutal and unnecessarily so. And so I had a protest about that, felt that it was not right, and that went into my book disguise. But in order to know kind of sort of what I was talking about, I went to work for the criminal division of the state of New Mexico, where I was employed for many years, and was able to study criminals, criminal behavior, criminology, rehabilitation, and restitution, and amends, and all that good stuff. And so all the meat and potatoes of that study and heart went into a few pages of it. This book really is a diary of my life experiences, but they're not set forth that way. They're dramatically conveyed through the characters. And the funny thing was, as I was writing it, I was also growing up and maturing and experiencing life, so that one idea I may have had and got all excited about and written at length about would come back 6 months later and it was completely no good anymore, because I had gotten an insight, an experiential lesson that proved to me that idea was not a good idea at all. But the premise was that the motivation, I guess, besides the challenge that I shared with Alan was okay, here's where we are, and this was early 70s. This is what our society looks like in the early 70s. And I don't know if you remember, I'm sure you do. It wasn't that long ago. And where we're headed, this planet is heading for light and life. So what does light and life look like? Okay, and then I went and I read paper 72, Government on a Neighboring Planet, and took from them many of their good ideas and looked at our world in the 70s, looked at life on a neighboring planet, looked at what we wanted to be the ideal, and it became a stepping stone from where we are to what we can do about it in order to get to where we want to go. And so it's all an effort to lead us into a healthy tomorrow. So it was, yeah, I created a civilization of people. And creating a civilization is not something you do over tea on one afternoon. It took a long time. And I really feel I was guided in the process by the creative muses.
Is this the core of your book, The Switch Mission?
Pardon me?
Is that the premise of your book, The Zoid Mission?
Yes, that's pretty much
Okay, so you essentially, would you say it's a work of fiction based on truth or reality?
It's allegorical.
And it's written as a novel.
Yes,
right?
it's written as a novel, yeah. Have you seen Zeitgeist, the addendum that's going around?
Yes, that's amazing.
Okay, that amazing material is the heart of that, the intensity and the integrity of that movement is precisely what went into my creating the Zoid Mission. But whereas theirs is a documentary, mine is a love story.
Okay.
So that's the guts of it is... These are important issues. I'm addressing some very important issues. And yet, you wouldn't know they were important, you know, because they're couched in romance and sci-fi and travel and whatever it all is that I constructed in the creation of this, of the novel. So it took a long time because it's very complex. And then made to look easy because I knew I couldn't talk about these things with readers since generally readers read at a seventh grade level. I couldn't be too sophisticated or too heady or too wordy or I'd lose them. People don't want to talk about going to prison. So I had to whittle that down. All that study had to be whittled down to something like 3 pages and made to be interesting. We bicycled through the complex, you know, so that they wouldn't feel threatened or intimidated by these heavy ideas. I didn't want to frighten people or bore them. So in order to entertain them, it took a lot of work, and I think that my characters do it effectively. People who have read it, most people who read it love it. Guys have somewhat of a problem with it sometimes because there's no violence in it. There's no explicit sex, although it's quite titillating, and, you know, romance is... I guess I'm old school, and what you don't see is more alluring than what you do see sometimes. But it's not hard sci-fi, and yet the category would probably be science fiction, more probably like Heinlein, Stranger in a Strange Land, than Asimov, but I call it metaphysical fiction.
One of the guys on our board said, no sex or violence, forget it.
Forget about it.
Well, there's a lot of conflict,
right,
though, but the conflict is within... Go ahead.
I love that concept that that you just presented, that sometimes what you don't see can be more interesting and intriguing and titillating, as you said, than when it's just all out there and everything's
right
on the table. And I always
think
of that great...
It takes better writing, better storytelling.
Well,
to make
I give
that
as an
true
example that great scene from Gone with the Wind where he forces, you know, he picks up Scarlett and carries her up the stairs. You know, and you don't see anything after that except the next morning she's so happy. You know, it leaves a lot to your imagination, and sometimes
yes,
that's a good. I like that.
Yes.
But also asked Gerdine, if you had an inspiration in your life, a human mentor that you'd like to share. And I really would love for you to tell us a little bit about this, your story and the story of your childhood, because I know you've been talking to angels since you were a small child. So
yes.
Tell us a little
yes
bit about your
story. About what?
Well, tell us a little bit about your story. The question was, who was your mentor in life?
I'll start with my mentor then. My mentor was my first husband. I've never met a person like Alan.
He was the one that challenged you to write the book with him?
Yes. I'm becoming emotional here.
Okay.
Minute.
Did Alan pass away?
It's allowed.
Yeah, he did. That's not what I'm finding emotional, though, is I cannot find the proper expletive to use on the air, but he was an extremely difficult man to live with. He was a homosexual. We didn't honor that while we were married. We both tried to be very normal and average about everything, but he was, in fact, a homosexual, and that put a bit of a strain on our personal relationship. He could be a screaming faggot under certain social circumstances, and he seemed to be such a grand ego that he always took the show. I mean, he was so flamboyant sometimes, but he was gifted. He was exciting. He was interesting. I was, for the most part, delighted to sit back and watch him perform because he was truly, he was great. But he could also be a real anus, you know. The thing about Alan was, though, his dedication to the Urantia book. It was profound. I have never known anyone as consecrated as he was. Now, how much of this was his, I cannot psychoanalyze him, but he was so dedicated to the Urantia book. I've just never seen anything like it. He was a transmitter, by the way. He was a channel. He called himself a contact personality. And when he and I both found the Urantia book in 1968, we didn't know each other. We were introduced to it by a mutual friend who was visiting us when we were both living on the north shore of Haula, Hawaii, Oahu. He had just dropped out from Las Vegas, and I had just dropped in from being a five-year hippie. And this fellow, Kip, Kevin Heinold, came
through. Oh, my gosh.
Through and, you know him?
We know Kip.
Yeah, well, Kip introduced both Alan and I to the Urantia book and to each other. And then I started going to Alan's house every day, practically, like most hippies did over there, because it became the new watering hole. And so that way I was exposed to the Urantia book. And also, incidentally, just to tell some story, so many of us had been hippies for so long, we had no idea how to behave ourselves in polite company. And Alan recognized this, and his partner, Bill Turner. So Turner and Smith, we called them. Turner and Smith recognized that we were socially backward, and so they encouraged us to become affiliated with the local Baha'is. And the Baha'is embraced us all. They surely must have thought that it was some kind of miracle, because maybe 10 of us all started going at the same time. And that enabled me to learn how to talk again, because for quite a while, all I really knew how to say was I'm hip and groovy and bitchin'. I sat on the floor and just had some very sloppy manners as far as sociability is concerned. And so the Baha'is helped me learn how to sit up straight and speak the King's English. And not that I didn't know how, but I had gotten out of the habit. And Alan was a very proper fellow. He had been, he was very cultured. He was educated, and his father had made a financial killing in the World War II from building something, I don't know. Anyway, he was raised a poor little rich boy, and so he'd gone to good schools, and so he taught me how to play bridge. He taught me how to comport myself, how to entertain. He taught me about opera. He was a wonderful, wonderful mentor. When he found me, I was totally an open book, an open slate. I had been basically a coal miner's daughter, and then I became a hippie. So, and after taking all those mind-expanding drugs, I was wide open. And he came along and molded me and created me in some ways. And the Urantia book was what I fed on. So all that empty space in me was filled up with the Urantia papers. And we had a passion for the revelation that was profound. And we also had a midwayer who was a part of our life, who visited with us regularly and encouraged our spiritual leanings. And so we were both mentored by a midwayer. And I have profound respect for the midwayers and abiding appreciation for their patience, their humor, their perspicacity. They're the best. I couldn't ask for better cousins. And so all that was quite wonderful and quite formative for me. We were divorced in 81, I guess it was, and he went his way and I went mine. But one of the things that we were committed to when we found each other, we didn't know there were any other Urantians on the planet, really. We were so in Hawaii on the North Shore, it was pretty remote. And when we got back to the States, we found out that there was a society of people, several societies, the Foundation, the Brotherhood, the study groups all over the place. And since we had joined together to reinforce our connection to the book and to promulgate and proselytize its message, we could see that there were lots of people doing it already, and it wasn't as vital that we continue to maintain our stance. And so the pressure was let up somewhat, and we were free then to pursue our own course. And so we did. But
what do you mean by that?
Well, we had dedicated our life to spiritual purposes. Basically, what we would do is, this was our modus operandi for the entire period of our marriage. When we weren't, well, we were always drinking. We drank every day. We had a happy hour every day. And we'd smoke a joint once in a while, too, if we had a chance. But otherwise, we talked about the Urantia book, we read the Urantia book, we studied the Urantia book, and we entertained people and established what we used to call the outrageous parlor so that we would be able to set it up to plant the seed, to arrange the atmosphere, to cultivate the moment when we could plant the seed for revelation. It's an art form, a social art form. I guess there are those who would call it celestial politics. But we were dedicated. We were just plain dedicated, not in a preachy fashion, because people don't want to see you coming. Say, oh, my God, here they come with the damn Urantia book again. So it was far, far more artful than that. But we would create an atmosphere, literally with the lighting, the music, the ambiance. And so the outrageous parlor became our venue. And we entertained a lot, and we were always cognizant of how can we plant a seed, how can we introduce these people to a higher consciousness, how can we plant ideas and concepts from the Urantia book in their mind, how can we whet their appetite for truth so as to lure them to ask questions or to wonder. And this is how we lived. It was wonderful. It was a wonderful way of living with spirituality on the edge of your seat. I felt really fulfilled. However, as a human, as a woman, I was not really fulfilled because he didn't desire me. And this really needled me and bugged me. And the closer I got to my sexual peak, the more difficult it was. And ultimately, I was unable to resist the call, and I asked him for a divorce. And so we were divorced, and I followed the call and learned how to become a mortal of the realm with all the trappings. And he did, too. And by that, I mean, obviously, I learned how to get my needs met. And he took the Urantia book then after visiting. Well, first he got sober. He got sober long about this point. And he took the Urantia book after visiting Lake Van in Turkey. He took the Urantia book into India, where he not just won, but he had an arrangement with the foundation to send books. And so he found places in homes and in libraries and in institutions, and they would send a book there. And he was in India for 2 years. And then he meandered on to Singapore and into Thailand, where he then succumbed to the call of nature. He fell in love with a young man, and about 10 years after our divorce, I visited him in Thailand, and it was so good to see him humanly happy. Of course, I was a little irked that I was not able to have made him happy like that, but and I learned a big lesson from that, and I was very happy to see him so in love and enjoying life. And still, reading his Urantia book and still doing the same thing. He was teaching English to young Thai people at the King's School in Chiang Mai. And he adopted Thailand as his home and died there in 2003. They would let him be who he was, you see. Our country is very provincial in that way, making progress, but it was brutal and cruel what they did to Alan and what they do to other homosexuals. No excuse for it.
Well, it sounds to me like Alan, like many of the people we might call mentors, and I love this insight, Gerdine. I got to tell you, I really enjoy this because, you know, sometimes life just leads us somewhere to somebody who has something to teach us, even though they may not know how much or the extent of which it sounds like in this case that's what it was. It sounds to me like Alan was your mentor in a willing and even an unwitting way, because you took in so much from him and you...
I did.
You've reflected on the lessons that you learned about your life with him a great deal, and I think that's the key to really getting the richness out of life, is to look, you know, to be conscious during, but also to be conscious after and look at the situations that you were in and glean what you can out of those situations. And you're reflecting, and the board is just really loving your story, and they're loving your honesty. They're loving, you know, the way you just say what you have to say. And some of the words you use shock some folks, but that's okay. We're, you know, you are a person who has come up through an interesting time in history.
Oh,
and
indeed.
Being an old hippie, and I was on the latter end of the hippie movement, it sounds like you were just right in the full-fledged, full-on hippie a phenomenon, and we've got
in the heart of it.
A lot of hippies found the Urantia book. I mean, they found it and they embraced it, and
yeah.
It was a big thing. And you said a couple things I'd love to touch on, because that was a wonderful story, and I want to just step back a little bit and touch on a few things you said. You said that a midwayer hung out with you guys. Can you elaborate on that, please? Because we're getting ready to do this event. Crystalline is planning a big event on 11-11-11. And as you know, 11-11-R is another way of describing the loyal secondary midwayers on your rancher. There's 1,111 of them. And so, you know, just numerically, 11-11-11 will only happen once in the history of the planet. Can you, well, I shouldn't say that. I guess 1911, it happened too. But it's, you know, this is a rare opportunity for us, let's just put it that way, to celebrate them and to celebrate our unseen friends and helpers. And you have a close relationship with our unseen friends and helpers. And I said that earlier. I know you said once on a post at Truthbook, you've been talking to angels since you were a small child. So elaborate how the midwayers would come and hang out with you and Alan.
Okay, there are a couple things while you were talking. I wanted to first tie a ribbon on that last story I was telling and maybe segue into this new era, a new conversation. But Alan told me later when he met me, the morning we met, I was walking along the highway to work on my first job, for which I was paid $1.65 an hour. And he and Kip had been up all night, and they were out on the highway, which ran along the ocean, watching the morning birds and whatnot and still talking. And so I'm walking along the highway, and there these two guys are, and Kip introduced the two of us. And Alan told me much later that when he was standing there and they looked down the road and saw me approaching, something in his mind said, "There's the woman you're going to marry." And this is peculiar because, as I said, he's gay, so why would he be lining me up to marry? But it was not his voice that told him that. It was the voice of destiny, because he didn't forget it. And when the time came, it was apparent why. Because we were able to companion each other in these higher ideals. Our marriage was a marriage of the spirit. It was more than humanly sacred. In fact, I don't think it was humanly sacred, but it was really a sacred arrangement, because we did a lot of good for each other and for humanity. Really, we did. All things being relative. Okay, now, talking about the invisible realms. Yes, when I was a child, like many children, I had invisible friends. Mine were Shoe and Sock. And Shoe and Sock were my companions from very early, before I had my baby brother born to me. And that changed the paradigm, but I was very close to Shoe and Sock. They were with me everywhere. I believe they were there when I received my thought adjuster, but they were profound enough. And everyone knew, all my family knew about Shoe and Sock, because I was not ashamed of them. I talked about them. And so Shoe and Sock were part of my development. And yet my dad said, "Well, you have to leave them here, because we're going to move and you're going to go to school, and you have to leave them behind. You don't want people to laugh at you, so you have to put them away now. And you're going to have a baby brother, and your mother's going to need you, and it's time to grow up." And so I did consciously let them go and mourned their passing, and then I was able to, of course, delight in the birth of my baby brother. But years later, I began to remember their unconditional love, their attentiveness, their camaraderie. They were like Marantia companions. They were always there for me, always friendly, always supportive, always having good advice. And I said, "I want them back. I mean, I need somebody like that. I'm not getting what I need from humanity. I'm being betrayed and getting the shaft. I'm not getting promoted. My relationships are turning sour. I need something here that's going to work. I want Shoe and Sock back." And that began my road to recovery. I did start going to AA, and the pink cloud that we talk about in program enabled me to have a second honeymoon with my higher power. It was like getting back to the divine spirit that I had known and remembered from the days before I lost contact with the spirits. The thing is, Alan was a contact personality, as you mentioned, and we spent many, many hundreds, maybe thousands of hours in incompatible discourse. Now, Jack, the times have changed, evidently. See, we are saying these days that the circuits are we're being reconnected, and the circuits are being modified such that correcting time is now here, and the teachers have come, and plans are being made for a magisterial son and all kinds of activity. But that was not the case in my day. In my day, it was still very secretive, very taboo. We were not to discuss our behaviors, our conversations. They wouldn't appreciate it. It would not bode well. And so we didn't tell others about it. And also, Jack always had to ask permission. Oh, Jack. Jack was what we called our midwear. He always had to ask permission for someone to come visit. He being the liaison personality, of course. And so through Jack, we were able to visit with sundry personalities. We had a Mighty Messenger. Mighty Messenger visited us frequently. We had a visit once from one without name and number. That was quite profound. That was such that I ended up in a ball in a fetal position in the chair. I felt so unborn around that entity, but all loving, all friendly. None were threatening. None were evil. It was all very nurturing and, again, cultivating the spiritual nature and whetting our appetites for greater spiritual food. Jack introduced himself in every session by saying 0802 AB Jack here.
What
I guess 0802 AB. Now, I know we look in the book and it's like ABC the third and ABC the second and so forth, indicating that it's three numbers. And yet Jack has persisted and consistently identified himself as 0802 AB. And I'm not arguing with him. That's how I know him. That's how I love him. And he early on said, but call me Jack, because I want you to think of me as just one of you guys. I'm just your cousin. Don't be putting me on any lofty perch. And so we developed a relationship with Jack and the secondary midwayer. And, when they tell the story about how the Urantia book got here, there was some point in there where they said, if you knew what you were dealing with, you would ask more intelligent questions. Jack did the same thing to us. He would tolerate our folder all for a while, and then he would get serious and he'd say, you could be asking about this or that, or if you were really serious you could oh blah blah. And I can't tell you how many times I was abashed to realize how self-centered I was. I hear some beeping going on, I guess. It's probably a solicitor.
Something real quick. Some comments came up on the board. Were there any when Jack would come? were there any hallucinogenics involved, or
no.
Would it come at all different times?
Well, it would come when we would sit down in the evening to talk to him. We made a conscious choice to go. Let's talk to Jack, and so we would talk to Jack. No, this was not something that was, there was no sex, drugs, rock and roll, or wild dancing. They were not under the influence of something. It was just something we did.
Was it something you did with your friends, with a group, or just you and Alan?
No, just Alan and I, because we were not at liberty to
share.
Yeah, he said, be quiet about this. Don't tell anybody about this. It's not that it's a secret. It's just there's a time and place for it, and it's not here yet. He said you will, which is funny because he said you'll know it when there's a change coming. However, and you'll recognize it when you see it. And so, of course, I took that to mean when later on the teaching mission came along, I was thrilled because I knew that that was what Jack had been talking about and setting us up for. But I want to go back and say that earlier on here in telling the story, is Jack and Alan and I moved from Hawaii, where we met and worked and lived, to San Diego and then on into New Mexico, where we settled. But where is it? Some thought I wanted to make in there relative to something important. I can't.
Well, you had been talking about how, you know, when you spent time with Jack,
right?
It was something that you kept quiet about.
Yeah.
And that it was just.
Well, for one thing, we had an experience in Hawaii where we did share with a woman there who was a Urantia Book reader, and she asked a question of Jack, and Jack answered the question, and she didn't like the answer. She objected, and she told the foundation and was quite angry about it. And so when we got to San Diego, shortly thereafter we moved, and I mean, not having to do with that, but just the timing was such that when we got in San Diego, we got a telegram from the foundation telling us to cease and desist. And so we could certainly see why Jack had been saying keep a lid on it, because it was not being well received.
Desisting to Jack?
Huh? Pardon
they
me?
Asked you to... They asked you
to cease
stop
and desist
talking.
This, yes, yes, a telegram to cease and desist. And
okay, wow. That, you know,
yeah.
That's interesting to me because, you know, I mean, you've established a couple of things that Alan was a contact personality. You call him a
yes.
contact personality.
Yes.
Alan brought Jack, and maybe, you know, I'm sure you are too, because of Shoe and Sock, some things are happening in your life that would make me think the two of you were brought together for
yes.
a reason, and
yes.
you were able to talk to Jack, and when Jack would show up, would he talk through Alan or you, or would he just talk to you like we're talking right now?
No, it was like we do in today in the teaching mission. He, although in those days, we didn't do it technologically. He, Alan wrote. He would hold the pen and write what Jack had to say. And I asked questions. And so my questions were not written down, but Jack's answers were written down. And Alan had deplorable handwriting. So I had to... decipher it right after we had the conversation or it would be lost. And I had reams of material, but when we left Hawaii, for some reason, we left it in it vanished. So all the stuff we had from the Hawaii years was lost. And I think that they did that on purpose. They lost it because it was really mostly human beings worried about human being stuff, the bills, the jobs, the pecky uni things that take up all your time and distract you from the important things, which is having a more spiritual focus. Not that life on life's terms is trivial. It's not. But I'm talking about like Nalda, the woman at the well, who liked to change the subject and look off to something else instead of having her focus on her reason for being here, which is God, of course.
We have a question on the board, and that is somebody's curious about what the question and answer was that the lady objected to. Do you remember that?
It had to do with the 12 tribes of Israel. I don't know exactly what it was, but it had to do with the 12 tribes of Israel.
Okay. Huh.
One of the tribes in particular.
You've been around the block many times with the teaching mission. And we haven't really explained what that means to anybody.
I saw it coming. I was so thrilled to see it coming, and I'll tell you, since then I have become extremely disappointed with how unlofty it has become and how ridiculous it can be. And it's just been a huge concern for me. But they forewarn this in the foreword, that even though this they run the risk of weakening lots of stuff, they're going to do it anyway. And so, you know, I don't know if that was decently expressed, but I think you get the principle. I'm not going to turn my back on the process because there's value in the process, but it is certainly a reflection on the fact that there are too few second milers and we really don't think deeply and we are not disciplined. Just for a million different reasons, I just can't stress enough the importance of discernment. You have to discern what you're hearing. And even people will hear complete gibberish and get excited about it because that's where they're at. Now, I have to remember that there was a time when I was full of gibberish, where I could look back and say, oh, my God, how in the world did Jack tolerate that? All that time, me talking about stuff that's not even important or that's so screwed up, it's just absurd. And gently and kindly and consistently and he always brought us back to the focus, always. No matter how far afield we got, he would wait until he had the opportunity, and he would bring us back into focus until eventually and gradually we wanted to be there. We wanted to be in the focus. It's the only thing we wanted to do was to be in focus. And so I have to say that this is an evolutionary process that more and more people are going through. And sometimes it is a circus. Sometimes I just can't look. But I have to have faith that this too shall pass and we will grow up.
Well, that's the name of the game on this planet. Say we have a caller. Can I take a caller, Gurdeep?
Certainly.
Let's see. Caller, you may be on Skype. I'm not sure what your area code is. You're on Blog Talk.
Greetings. I just tuned in, so I'm just listening at the moment.
Okay. Well, we'll let you listen then.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Uh-huh.
You bet. Okay, so we have a question on the board, Gurdeep.
Okay.
If ever heard of the Traveling Light Circus, Jamal
no.
and Zabriel, 71 and 72?
No.
No? Have not heard
no.
of that. Okay.
No.
So you've expressed that you're a little disappointed in some of the directions the teaching mission has gone in. And just to clarify for the folks that don't know, the teaching mission and a lot of things that are going on. I was spending a lot of time in the New Age movement because I was introducing the Urantia book at
yeah.
New Age Expo all
yeah.
through the 90s. And that's you mentioned the other day that's where you and I met
right.
in Pennsylvania. And I remembered that jogged my memory. Thanks for helping me with that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's been a lot of channeling going on in several movements, not just in the Urantia movement. It started
right.
in the early 90s in the Urantia movement, and the Urantia book readers call it the teaching mission, and they understand that teachers have been given to the world in order to help us transition into the next phase of existence. And and of course, you know, it's all very subjective, and you certainly, if you're going to go down that road, you certainly have to be willing to stop and listen and discern what you can discern, because like you, I have found, and I know Chrislyn would probably agree, a lot of it is not what you describe your experience with Jack to be. A lot of it is just silly fluff and stuff. And not to disparage any of it, from my point of view, I mean, compared to the Urantia book, it's like a candle next to the sun. And the Urantia book is such an amazing document. I mean, 36 years later, and I feel like if I read it the rest of my life, I wouldn't even begin to scratch the surface on all it has to give me. And I know so many other Urantia book readers who feel that. And I also know that, you know, Sadler said things about, you know, that the Urantia book was not automatic writing. It was not spiritualism. We're kind of in this strange place in this movement where, you know, on one hand, we have the great scientist who was a debunker of spiritual phenomenon, Dr. Sadler, who was actually the one who fostered these teachings through a contact personality and gave them to the world, even though he himself spent most of his time debunking this kind of phenomenon. He couldn't debunk the Urantia book. So there's a point where you say, well, a lot of it's not real, but some of it is. And I've heard other stories from people. I think I shared this on the air before. About a fellow in the South, he calls himself Evangel, and he was with a group of people, and Jesus showed up in the group, and they all wet themselves. And your comment about, and to me that seems like, wow, that's what someone who's a lot in their animal brain would do if a superior being showed up. That made
yeah.
sense to me. You know, that to me was like the earmark of, oh, wow, yeah, that, now I buy that. You know, that makes sense to me. And when you said when the solitary messenger showed up, you went into a fetal position because you felt almost unborn in his presence.
One without name and number.
And one without name and number, okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense to me. That,
mm-hmm.
Because you know what? On this planet, we are unborn to a certain degree. We're spiritual embryos.
Well, we all start out that way.
Yeah, right. So that makes sense. But, you know, how do you deal with the skeptics? I mean, they don't, you know, and let's face it, we all deal with it. We want to tell people about the Urantia book, and the skeptics tell us we're crazy. You don't really believe that stuff.
I know. It's very unfortunate.
We're all
in
the
same boat. It's unfortunate.
Yeah.
It breaks my heart. And yet I understand it. I understand it. What can you do? You have to let people have their own experience. Like, they have to let me have my experience. I have to let them have their experience and know that it's going to be okay. Although it may not seem so at the moment, it will work itself through. We are finite. We can't make too big a mess of it. when the finite is a shadow of the light, and the light will win. So
I would like to make a comment or have a question. This is Ron.
Sure. And Ron.
Give Gurdine a chance to take a sip of water. He's been talking a long time.
Thank you, Ron.
I believe that we are all on our own personal path towards the Father. Some find that path to be beneficial by embracing the teaching mission. Some find the path to be only with the Urantia book. Some find the path to be Catholicism or Hinduism or Judaism. And I think it's important that we all recognize that we're all on a different path. We're all different, extremely unique beings. And this is the purpose of what the Father has created, for us to add our unique experiences to his experience. And that it's okay if some people reject the teaching mission or reject the Urantia book or reject all religion because they're not going to be able to accept what may be truth for me or truth for you until they're ready to accept it. As I was not ready to accept the Urantia book until I actually was exposed to it in the early 70s. I was also not ready to accept the truths that I find in the teaching mission until I was exposed to it in 2009. So I think we're all on our own individual path, and I think it's wonderful that everybody just accepts each other for where they are in their progress and not to characterize anyone as being delusional or egomaniacal or any other disparaging comments, which I find most distressing from Urantia book readers, who I assumed would be loving, kind, open individuals, and I've experienced some distressing experiences, at least on Facebook, which I call the modern equivalent of show and tell. But my main question, Gurdine, for you is, when you are TRing or you receive a message from a celestial being, how do you know that it's true and not just a construct of your mind? Because that seems to be the major complaint that I hear from Urantia book readers who are skeptical of the mission, and they should be. You know, they should not accept it until they're ready to. So how do you know that what you are hearing is actually from either your thought adjuster or from Thomas or Michael or anybody else who you speak to?
I don't, Ron. In fact, I do think they're constructs. I've come to this conclusion because I have been unable to accept all the teachers that come down the pike. And so I've had to sit and soul search myself and say, well, why can you believe in this one but not that one? And so I finally said, I don't believe in any of them. I think that they are all constructs that we created in order to convey our thoughts and feelings and spirits, a way to teach and preach, a way to sing, a way to sell books, a way to, I mean, I do think they're a construct. And yet, they have value, and it's the value that we're looking for, not the trappings. It's the value that's in there. It doesn't matter whether they're real or not. What's real is the substance that we take from it. And if there's nothing in it for you, then don't worry about it. But there are those of us who do find value in it, and we delight to put the trappings on it of nomenclature and design and personality. And eventually it becomes real enough to be substantive, like spending time with Urantia companions, for example. Have spent many hours with Urantia companions, and they are companionable. As a result of spending time with Urantia companions, I have learned how to be a decent companion. That's the value of it. It doesn't negate a Mirage companion. It values what they have to share.
And so, therefore, when you
and therefore they are real, but they are teachers. But they are teachers only because we choose to learn through our own machinations, through our own co-creative efforts. We have to, it's like we put ourselves in their shoes. You want to know how it feels walking another man's moccasins? Well, I have walked in the moccasins of midwayers and talked to midwayers to the extent that I understand what midwayers are and what they do and what they've experienced, and they've become real for me. Now, there are also phenomenon above and beyond. I mean, this is just me, how I manage to stay sane. But there are also phenomenon that occur that I have no explanation for, like seeing Jesus in the Mirage state. I have no explanation for that. Certain manipulations of the material environment, like the stone being rolled away from the cave, or car keys showing up missing, or parking spaces being available, or miracles in the recovery room, or, I mean, there's a lot of things that are obviously not constructs, that are obviously spirit-induced, but I can't explain them. The spirit is bigger than I am. I can accept a whole lot on faith, but if it's anything I have something to do with, it's probably going to be brought down to a level that I can understand it or explain it or convey it.
Do you feel like it is acceptable to question when someone claims to have revelatory information, to question, or, you know, like you say, you think that discernment is really important? I think we can't automatically assume that all who say that they are contact personalities are in fact real.
Right.
And I think that that's where some of the conflict comes up in this movement, is that so many people who have made those claims.
Well, let them make it. What the heck? Yeah, go ahead. You know, who am I to say that I was not Cleopatra in a former life? Were you there? Do you know? We don't know. So let them have what it is they think they need. We don't need it anymore. So just let it go. It's kind of like some of this is like children who come prancing out in their mother's shoes. That's where they're at. We're to show affection for our immature brothers and sisters as if they were our children. And yeah, there's a certain amount of, well, if they're going to be children, then I'm going to have to straighten them out and educate them. Well, geez, you know, have mercy. There's one thing about this is it is fun. It can be fun. It's no worse than watching TV incessantly or playing Freecell incessantly. In fact, it stimulates the mind. It stimulates the creativity. If it doesn't amuse you, don't worry about it. It's kind of like live and let live.
Mm-hmm.
If we would quit taking these things so seriously, maybe other people would quit taking themselves so seriously.
Mm-hmm.
You said some very important things, and totally, I agree with you. You know, and Ron, you too. I am distressed when I see readers beating each other up over this stuff, because ultimately Jesus had a simple acid test for religious truth. He said, if it brings man closer to God, if it brings God closer to man, it's good.
Right on.
And he didn't judge. Yeah, he did. Even Kermit, right? Even when the apostles went and ducked him in the lake and stuff, Jesus said, forbid him not.
Mm-hmm.
He was not against us, is for us. Even now, we should rejoice that these teachings have reached beyond the boundaries of our own influence. And I'm paraphrasing, of course, but I wanted to share an exact quote from Jesus. And it's from one of my very, very favorite discourses. It's from the Discourse on Religion, and two discourses he does in the Urantia Book on Religion. One is the Discourse on Religion and the Second Discourse on Religion. This particular quote is from the Second Discourse on Religion. He's talking about the difference between the religion of the spirit, which I think, Gurdine, that's what you're getting at. Each one of us has a personal relationship with God, an experience with God, an experience like Byron Bilitis likes to call it, romancing the universe. And when you said we could have fun with it, I agree, we could have fun. If we leave our judgments at the door, you know, not that we leave our discernment at the door, we leave our judgment at the door. And I think that's an important distinction. But we'll never get along with all of the religionists on this planet if we don't learn to do that. Jesus says in that discourse, and he says so many things, it's like every word in that discourse is something that you can just take and think about and keep in your heart forever. If I could memorize it word for word, I would. The Second Discourse on Religion. He says, you must seek for the Word of God only on the pages of the olden records of theologic authority. Those who are born of the Spirit of God shall henceforth discern the Word of God regardless of whence it appears to take origin. Divine truth must not be discounted because the channel of its bestowal is apparently human. Many of your brethren have minds which accept the theory of God while they spiritually fail to realize the presence of God. And that is just the reason why I have so often taught you that the kingdom of heaven can best be realized by acquiring the spiritual attitude of a sincere child. It is not the mental immaturity of the child that I commend to you, but rather the spiritual simplicity of such an easy believing and fully trusting little one. It is not so important that you should know about the fact of God as that you should increasingly grow in the ability to feel the presence of God.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Wonderful.
Yeah. It is that easy believing aspect that causes me most concern, because there are some people who will believe anything you tell them. And I feel that we who have the Urantia Book and we who have one brain cell to rub against the other have a responsibility to these youngsters to help guide their progress, not to lambaste them and insult them, but to guide and cultivate them. Big difference.
Right.
I agree.
And, you know, to discount another person's experience is it's to discount them.
Yeah.
You can't do it. All you can do, the most you can say is, well, that's not my experience, but I honor yours. It's like the Hindus. They say, the God in me honors and acknowledges the God in you. And being Urantia Book readers, you know, Ron, you posed the question, why do we? Well, it's distressing when we treat each other badly, that we go out on the road and treat a total stranger with more kindness and mercy, as you put it, Gurdine, than we would someone who shares a belief in this magnificent revelation with us, just because they have a different experience of the universe. And I think what part of the problem is, and this is what I've identified, and I know we've gotten way far afield from the original topic of this program, folks, and I'm sorry, but I think it's important to discuss this. You know, what I identify is that most humans crave. Let's think about it for a minute, Gurdeen, because you said, you know, when you wrote your book, The Zoid Mission. You imagine what it would be like to be in a state of light and life. Let's imagine what it would be like if Adam and Eve were still here. If they had not defaulted and they were still here, there would be a cultural center on this planet like nothing this planet has ever seen. It would be rich with art and philosophy and religion in ways and expressions that we can't even imagine. Just because those two beings had stayed here to guide this planet, to do exactly what you just said, Gurdeen, to guide us, to help us find our spirituality, find the real purpose and meaning of our own selves, of our life, help us to romance the universe. They would be our representatives here. Imagine how that would affect us if we knew that there are these two beings and all of their children, millions of their children on this planet, been here for 37,000 years. They're not going away. That in itself would be miraculous to even it's miraculous to even imagine. How would that affect us? Now, we don't have that. We know we don't have that. We might have had it, but it didn't work out that way. What happens then is it creates in us this longing to touch the celestial realm, to have that representation. Oh, we want it so badly. We crave it. It's in us. We'd be foolish to deny that it is. It is in us. We crave that contact with the spiritual realm. We know it's real. We crave that contact that Adam and Eve would have given us that bridge to, but because they're gone, we don't, and we feel alone. We feel orphaned and isolated. Now comes somebody who has that or claims to have that contact. It's very, very seductive. And this is where I think people balk, and this is where it gives people pause, because somebody can misuse that to their own benefit and say, well, I have a hotline, and I know you want contact, so come to me, and I will give you that. And I think that's my biggest drawback with it. But if we have discernment, and we really have to practice it carefully then, when anybody is claiming to be in contact with the celestial realm. And it's just like the Urantia book. It claims to be a gift from that realm. We really have to look at that carefully and decide for ourselves if we believe it. And I tell people that all the time. Look, don't take my word for it. Read it. And then you tell me what you think. If you don't believe that it's of anything I've ever found, if that's not the real deal, I would love to see the real deal. If you can show me something more pure in its intellect, more pure in the power of its love and the empowerment that it gives to humanity and to individuals, I would love to see it. Because that one floats my boat. Man, does it float my boat. And the effect just gets stronger. But, as you have pointed out, Gurdeen, many great teachings on this planet do that for people. And we get to be the decider.
Yeah. Actually, that's I think that was Ron who pointed that out, but I could be wrong.
Well, maybe Whatever. It was Ron. Sorry, Ron. We get to decide, though. And that's empowering
okay.
to us.
We all get to decide for ourselves, and like you say, what's true for one may not be ring true for another, and that's okay because we're all such wonderful, unique, diverse creatures, and we need to accept ourselves and our brothers for what they believe in and not try to change them and not berate them and not put them down and not call them a tool of the Kalagastia. But I just want to have everybody love one another, especially your Urantia book readers. I don't see how we can relate to other religionists when we are so disrespectful of ourselves.
This is where we come back to this recovery thing. When we are so disrespectful of ourselves, it's because there's something in us that we're not happy with that we have to project it out onto our peers. This is just one of those laws of the universe. And so if we find something wrong in our fellows, it's because there's something we haven't resolved within ourselves. And I can say this because I have made a total ass of myself among my peers, screaming at them, telling them what fools they are, and the same thing. I am guilty of the same thing that I lament others do, and this is how we learn. Many truths are not felt except in adversity, and unfortunately, that's coming and going. And all the more reason, frankly, to be as merciful as we can with each other when we can and when we have a chance, to be as loving as possible. It's like that thing that's going around the internet these days. Be nice to people. You don't know what kind of a day they're having. And when we're recovering from the vagaries of such a life on such a planet, it can get very tender. We have been wounded. You can get wounded just going out into traffic, putting up with rush hour traffic can be an ordeal. And the more stressed we are because of the war situation, the economic situation, the political situation, the Egypt situation, the Arizona situation, these things, they pelt us with fears and stresses and anxieties, and you know, life's difficult. Even as a spiritual person having a human experience, it's a difficult experience. And so the more we can remember that and be as kind and gentle, then we are, you know, let there be peace on earth and let it begin with me. I'm vulnerable to shooting from the hip when an insult comes at me. I am just as eager to retort and return it as anybody. But I know that it's fruitless. It's like cheap thrills. It makes you feel good for a minute, but then you're going to feel like crap because you succumbed to your baser nature. I do a lot of animal training and cause my ego to heal. And I'll tell you what, when you're sitting, transmitting, letting the entity have the floor, and you just sit there and listen and be quiet, is a tremendous discipline in keeping yourself from jumping in where it's none of your business or where you might like to. Tremendous discipline.
I've learned something valuable from my Urantia Facebook experience, and that is never post in anger. I always sleep on it, talk to my father fragment, talk to Michael if I can, and receive some kind of guidance and wait until the next day. I think that's the most valuable thing I've learned in the last month.
Yeah. Yeah, I can walk away these days. I don't have to stay and fight to the death. I can walk away, and if they say, well, where did she go? She got out of the ring, that's what.
You took a time out.
Yeah.
You know, I had an experience as a young bride where my husband, my first husband, not my current husband, Glenn, my first husband, Robert, was killed in a car accident. And but he used to love to goad me into a fight. And I would go there with him. And one day, he was trying to goad me into a fight. And I felt this dark cloud come into my head. I was a Urantia book reader at this time. And I felt this dark cloud come into my head. And I was standing there at the kitchen sink doing dishes, and he was sitting at the table behind me saying things, you know, that he knew would make me want to defend myself. And this dark cloud came into my mind, and I thought, you know what? I choose this not. I choose it not. I have a choice, and I don't have to go here. I don't have to defend myself just because he's goading me. Mm-hmm. I don't have to engage in this fight. And I said, you know, I'm sorry you feel that way. And I dried my hands and I went down and did laundry. And he didn't follow me downstairs to goad me down there. And I learned something very valuable, and it's just what you said, Ron. I learned that I don't have to engage in an argument, and I don't have to get angry. And it was so valuable to me with this particular human in my life, because I realized that if I leave him alone for 20 minutes, when I come back, he'll be fine. And it worked like magic. And so the idea of sleeping on it or taking a minute, as you said, Gurdine, you know, letting your mind be still. Let someone else have the floor if that's what they want. You know, it's not just, you know, the entity, as you put it. It's also the other human in the room. Just let them have the floor if that's what they need. And if they want to have a tantrum and scream and yell and throw themselves down and whatever, okay. I don't have to do it, too.
I've never had a celestial have a temper tantrum, however, so I've never had to back down from that.
Thank God. But, you know, it's just, it's important that we are, and again, I think of Jesus in the shipyard talking to the fellow. He worked in the shipyard at one point, and a fellow who was there with him would listen to his stories, and he made the great comment, if the gods are so great, why do they leave me here with this taskmaster of a boss? Why don't they have some mercy on me? And, of course, Jesus said, well, perhaps you are the salt that will restore his savor if you haven't lost your own. Mm. And he goes on to say how, you know, we can be the master of any situation if we'll just let that happen. And I think that's important to remember. You are a person, Gurdine, that, you know, I think has developed a lot of wisdom in life. And you said something earlier about constructs. I think it's human constructs, and I wondered if you would be willing to elaborate on that a little bit.
I believe spirit is real, but it's like you, Paula, you have a thought adjuster, you have a soul, you have a character, you have reality. And yet, I know you because we met in Pittsburgh. The same thing is true about invisible entities. There's heart and soul and consciousness and spirit. I didn't meet them in Pittsburgh. I met them in my mind. And so I had to construct them there. Jack is very real to me. Jack has taught me so much. He cannot be anything but real because he has given me so much reality. And Teacher Thomas and I have been sidekicks since 1993. I love Thomas. He to me is very real. But I have a hard time acknowledging the reality of Monjorensen, and so he's not real to me. And so what am I going to say, that my guy is real and your guy isn't? I can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
I can't do that. If I'm going to be in this venue of operation, of transmitting, of conveying truth through this means, then I have to be fair. Plain old fruits of the spirit. I can't be selective. I choose not to follow a lot of the various New Age movements. Not because they don't have value, but because they don't pertain to me at this level of my growth or at this stage in my development. There are tons of New Age movements that I could affiliate myself with or address or argue with. I'm just thrilled that they're there because I know that they're part of the solution. They're keeping their minds alert. They're bringing spirit into the equation. I sometimes even set the teaching mission aside because my roots are in the Arantia book. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's all a circus, and I don't want to have anything to do with any of it. And I'll come back to the foundation and get refreshed, and the master, the father, the divine minister, the adjutants, Makaventa, these are not constructs. I believe these are real because they've been reinforced to me through the revelation. And that's my loyalty to the revelation above and beyond any of the organized religions, above and beyond the teaching mission, above and beyond anything. This is my foundation. But in order for me to teach this revelation, the New Age is my venue. The teaching mission is my primary venue. It's just like, you know, somebody wants to go into a career in this world. They have their foundations, and then they pick a career, and some go into psychology, some go into nursing, some go into being a chef. Well, I've put mine into the teaching mission. This is where I do my work. This is where I work for God, mostly. This is, you know, I still do personal ministry, and I still have I'm cultivating a dedicated Urantia book study group, and I still, you know, there's many ways that I can be of service and minister, but my public ministry is through the teaching mission. And with my experience in as a hippie, as a woman in recovery, as a Urantia book reader, as a transmitter receiver, that's where I belong. That's where I fit. That's appropriate for me. And so I am appropriately doing my father's will. And that's all I'm going to say about that.
You know what? I absolutely see that in you. And thank you for that. That is a beautiful insight. And it's beautifully stated. As I knew you would. You're a very articulate person. And I really appreciate what you just said. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you, Paula.
And, you know, sadly, folks, we are out of time. Crystal, I feel like I totally hogged this show, and I'm sorry.
No problem. I've had some technical difficulties today, so I've just been, listening mostly. But I really have appreciated
Usually you do break in there more, but, you know. Gurdine, it was such a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you for inviting me.
You did a beautiful job, and in your story is wonderful and fascinating. I loved hearing about you being, very familiar with the hippie movement. I loved what you brought up, and the story of Alan. I feel like I know him. I love him now. And I bless him wherever he is in the mansion world for being your partner and being your mentor. And I bless you for doing the work you do and the community you do. And it totally resonates with me. You're serving a community that needs your love and wisdom. And God bless you.
I have a new husband now, by the way.
I know.
Who's serving me also very well. I didn't want to leave Angus out of this picture. He's my Prince Charming who's made my dreams come true. So, you know, I just don't want to leave it... that Alan was all that I've had in my life. I've I've got a wonderful man now, and I've.
And you met him at a Urantia conference, and wow, that makes me feel good to know that, because, you know, we put a lot of work into those, so a lot of people meet each other there, and that's fantastic.
I married him there. I met him on the internet, but we married at IC99.
You married him there. That's right. That's
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. And a lot of people share that experience, too. They meet at conferences, but you're right, they marry there, too.
Yeah.
It's just a wonderful environment for that.
A love fest.
It is
so
a
my
love
heart
fest, for sure.
And I'm going to publish your site again. It's Harp of God.
No.
I'm putting it on the board right
well,
now.
Yeah, that's where my books are. Yeah, harpofgod.org.
Right. And your site is...
OdellBowen.com, OdellBowen.com, and from there you can visit ZoloidMission.com, read about the spirits of promise, about the adjutants and chakras. You can take a look at some of my art, visit Ms. Odell's studio, see some of my artwork. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff there. OdellBowen.com.
Right. I published both of those on the chat board. And, you know, again, we're out of time. Our show's not even on anymore. But I hate to say goodbye. It's been so much fun talking to you today. Thank you so much.
It has been a good time.
Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your work with us and telling us more about your story. It's a great story.
Have a good day, ladies. Ron,
okay.
Thank
you.
Have a you
wonderful
too.
Week.
Bye-bye.
And we'll be in touch.
Bye.
All right.
Thank you.
Take care.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, Crislin, that's another one. It went by fast. And thank you, friends. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week on The Cosmic Citizen. Until then, have a blessed and wonderful week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.